Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. We continue today with Connie Ellis's reading of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a handful of people in a northern Minnesota town. We pick up now where Connie left off last time.
Chapter 3 continues. Stan was too tired to keep thinking. He lay down on Silver's blanket. Just before falling asleep, he planned what was left of his marriage. He intended to be a good enough husband to Ginny until he died, but he absolutely was not going to sacrifice any more hours of his life to her than he could help it, however he could decently manage it. When he awoke, it was still only midday on Saturday. He went through his thoughts about Vera's pickup. Stan told her that he thought he could repair that pickup she'd brought in just for an oil change. He told her he could hear something in it, and would she bring the old buggy in again and leave it with him until he and Kenneth, the mechanic, could figure it out. "Can't do it," she had said. "School funding cuts. No raises this year." He said, "Just give us a look. No charge." That sound could be anything from just a loose box for the exhaust to something about the timing or a flat place on one or more tires. You can't go by sound. "I'll call you up and tell you what's wrong, and I'll quote you a price. The price doesn't work for you, you tell me up front, and we don't fix it until you have more money lying around." Then he laughed to show her this was a joke. She laughed and said, "You got that much right. Money lying around." He gave her shoulder a slap and said, "Think about it. The offer holds." To himself, Stan sighed. Don't touch people's shoulders anymore. He had picked up on a fast glimmer of horror Vera gave him. For a moment he had forgotten that he looked like hell, and anyway, word was all over St. Fursey that he had lung cancer, so he told himself, "You are going to have to bite the bullet here. You tell someone some offer holds, but if you obviously are going to die, soon they know the offer might just not hold up with whoever takes over your dealership when you're gone. Also, in places of business, women pretend to be mad if you presume to touch them. That was okay, all part of the game, but when you are sick with cancer, they do a fast cringe if you touch them, the way Vera had nearly ducked from his friendly pat. She had brought the pickup in Thursday. He took Kenneth off a juicy transmission job, told him to do a worksheet for Vera's pickup. Kenneth listened to what Stan was telling him between the lines, as well as what he actually said. Namely, he would understand that Stan wanted to know what all was wrong with Vera's wreck of a pickup, and he would want the diagnosis in two categories, expensive plus fixable, and inexpensive plus fixable. He would all the while know that vehicle needed to be put out of its misery. Kenneth had eaten and returned. He still had his jacket over his arm. It was a red and gray letter jacket, number 50, from 5 years ago, when he played at left tackle for Cullah High School. He came to stand over stand. "On that 1990 F-150, Kenneth said, "what about if both lists are so long that maybe we're talking going to the crusher?" "Give me a look," Stan said. "Have a seat." Kenneth started to lay his letter jacket onto the sofa arm, saw Silver's hair all over, and folded it up into his lap instead. Stan took Kenneth's sheet. "I see what you mean," he said after a moment. "I was afraid it would be like that." He read aloud. "To start with, the brakes, calipers, and rotors bad in front and the pads gone. And in the rear, the drums had shot, brake linings gone. The catalytic converter worn out, sulfur smell, the water pump was shot, so the trunk overheated. The radiator needed to be flushed. Heater did not warm up, which might be the thermostat. This vehicle needs new plugs. The brake fluid was leaking at the wheel cylinders. The grinding noise around the rear axle might be, probably was, a wheel bearing, or it was a U-joint. or bearing in the differential. The oil pump was not working. The radiator hoses were leaking oil into the engine. There was a bad head gasket, very bad, sending black smoke out the exhaust. As for the body, chassis rusted through in 5 visible places. Back bumper's coming off. Tailgate can't be closed. Well, the owner knew that. She had already tied clothesline around the bed and stabilized it with duct tape. Tires worn out, 3 with flat places. Wheels need alignment, balancing. Kenneth laughed. He said, "But you might want to keep it safe enough by fixing on the brakes front and rear and, like, get that oil drip stopped so it's not dropping right onto the hot metal anywhere. One person could do that." "I'll talk to her," Stan said. "Meantime, park it out back on the back slab somewhere till I see what Vera says." They both got up. Stan climbed into a Savannah on its last month of cheap inventory. It was snowing heavily now, bad on a Saturday. People didn't do inspiration buying of new cars on snowy Saturdays, although they would drive to a Walmart all the way up to Cullo or even Chisholm. He glided along 4th Street, past the bakery, noting that it was full, as of course it would be because there was yesterday's murder victim to talk about. A nearby murder of a stranger was perfect for pulling everyone out of every knothole in the Superior National Forest. Gave you the shivers, but you weren't obliged to feel anything at all about it if you didn't want to. Kind of a real-life substitute for reality TV. Stan decided to cruise Tenebrae Creek Drive. He had avoided it for a few days, since views of the meadows to the west reminded him of Silver. He and she used to follow Tenebrae Creek south. He decided to go up into the north corner where people lived, who never bought a late model from him or any dealer and probably never would. At this upper end, Tenebrae Creek Drive faded into a gravel road. There were 2 ratty apartment buildings and a number of stands for mobile homes. Only 3 pickups stood near the stands. Down economy. He passed the apartment building run by an out-of-town fellow who still drove a 1980 Honda. Stan had planned to wait until that Honda was a year older, then get into a conversation with the man about moving up in the world, say to a 1998 GMC something. Now that Stan was so sick, he shouldn't wait another year. Kenneth had fixed and shined up the 1999 Audi. It wasn't Stan's kind of car, but it had Audi mystique. He'd offer $1,000 plus or minus on the Honda, then let him have the Audi for $11,000 starting. Stan slowed. His 2 o'clock appointment was in the other rundown building, but not for another hour. Why cruise around here now? He was embarrassed. He was actually yearning and yearning for that 2 o'clock appointment. Someone to talk to, someone professional who would keep her mouth shut. All day he had been waiting and the hours scarcely moved. Now all of a sudden it was nearly 2 o'clock. He U-turned in the snow and drove to his appointment. He began cussing aloud to himself in the car. He was not some pussy-whipped piece of sickness who would go to a therapist. He was doing a business-like thing. When he needed advice on extended cab pickups, he called up the technical man at Oshawa. When he had precise needs, he got someone to address them. So it was the same thing. This woman was the expert. He was going to her to confirm what he already knew, but needed to be sure of. So what made him so sure Emma Jean Tenebrae would be so smart? She had to be 10 or 11 years younger than he. How could she answer any questions of his? He knew what it was. He was not going to her to find out how to die. He would do that by himself. Still, part of the reason he was going to her was that she knew something about death. He had heard the story that everybody in town knew. Years ago, when Emma Jean was just local big-shot Peter and Natalie Tenebrae's daughter, fresh out of college, she had married someone. They had had a child. That child was drowned in a flooded open-pit mine that one of the mining companies was finished with. People fished in it, but it was hundreds of feet deep. You had to be careful. Town gossip was unreliable on this kind of subject. That is, since the young husband was not local, nothing stopped people from saying he had been negligent, taking a baby out in an open boat. Maybe he had been. Maybe he was not like that at all. The Tenebrays didn't share their private lives with folks having coffee at the bakery, or even after church. They were said to give bash-up dinner parties on the weekends, where other Episcopalians who were college graduate types went. But news never sifted from those parties out to Stan's acquaintance, or the Friday night philosophers at the VFW. Emma Jean Tenebrae sat with the other altos in the weekly ecumenical rehearsals. Stan had been watching her. From the tenor section, he regarded the back of her neck. She didn't seem to whisper to people on either side. When it was break time, he edged around to where she was talking to people, balancing the bendy little paper plates that tended to drop your crusts on the floor. He knew that she didn't jeer at people. His Ginny now, she always seemed to be in a little group with their heads lowered in close. They were always in the know about something that others were not invited to hear. This Imogene looked so different that he trusted she would be different. Now that he was about to step outside his life, he was so glad to get to talk to someone like her who was already naturally way outside his life. As he parked the Savannah among wrecks of pickups outside Imogene's wreck of a building, he wondered again, why didn't she live with her parents in their beautiful four-generation mansion? This place didn't even have an elevator. The staircase was lighted by one low-wattage bulb. By taking a break halfway up, making himself count to 100, Stan Garris made it up the second flight of stairs. Its upper landing was very dark, but he found her bell. A scotch-taped sign said it was out of order, so he knocked. He found himself delighted to be invited into her living room, like a new kid coming into a bright-lighted kindergarten. Two huge windows gave out to the west, where even so early the sky was darkening behind that snowfall. The whole room was misty and gold. He felt exorbitantly shy. "Coffee over there if you want it," said the woman he'd come to see. "Take your time," she added. As for her eyes stayed leisurely away from his face. She appeared perfectly all right with looking out the huge windows over the rough grass toward Tenebrae Creek. The new snow didn't yet cover the dull brome and quack of the meadow. All week there had been a mother bear and a cub out there, all around the town. Perhaps that's what she was doing, having a glance to see if she could spot them. "Pretty," Stan said. He sat down. Imogene now swung her face around to him. "Tell me why you've come," she said. Stan was startled, but the face across from him looked respectful and curious, not sardonic. Being startled, though, he blurted the truth at her. "I want to do three ideas that are a little different from anything I've done before." She waited. She didn't raise her eyebrows with a vague expression of interest. "The first one," Stan said, "is the easiest because it's in my line. I want to fix up a busted and worn-out pickup and do it all at low cost to the owner, safety-wise. The darn thing ought to go to the crusher." "But you're thinking of fixing it?" "Well, basically my mechanic will, Kenneth." Imogene Tenebrae smiled at him. Stan checked her face carefully. He couldn't see any trickiness in the expression, so he leaned back. She was beautiful, of course. But then she would be. Her mother, who directed the ecumenical choir each evening, Natalie, was sharp-looking even at 50 or 55, whatever she was. Sharp-looking even when low-buzz drunk. Stan did not feel sidetracked by Imogene's looks, however. He was bracing up to his job here, his own agenda. He talked a little faster now because he felt he could make the important points clear to her. He felt he had better tell her exactly how Kenneth was a first-rate auto mechanic. And about George, too. You didn't have a good salesperson, you couldn't run a good dealership at all. She was listening. Then Stan got confused because he realized he hadn't said who the owner was. It was terribly important to get it all clear for her. She needed the data. Vera Hall, he told Imogene. Imogene spoke. It's Vera who has the pickup needing a lot of work then, she said, getting it right. Stan was glad she seemed to be someone who wanted to be sure she had the facts right. She now said in a quiet voice, Have I got this right? You are going to offer Vera Hall a repair job that she can afford even though a lot is wrong with her car? Pickup. Yes, yes, that's it exactly, he said. Neither said anything for a second. Then Imogene said, Did you want to say anything more about that, or do you want to tell me about the other two ideas you are working on? Working on, he thought. That was a new one. Well, she was right. He was working on those ideas, in his head, just as much work as any other planning. He said, I'll probably just tell you the one and let the other go. Or maybe if there is time, I will tell you both. The other one doesn't matter so much, probably, so I'll tell you the one. His own voice, when he listened to it aloud, told him that the other idea was the important one, and the one he proposed to tell this therapist was the less important. Live and learn, he thought. This project is about Dieter Stoltz. He's in the ecumenical chorus. Imogene explained. He's the one with the wonderful tenor voice. He has a terrific voice for a tenor, and he keeps the time right, too. I used to know him personally, she added. She seemed to be deciding whether or not to say something more. She said, I know the gossip. Some people hold it against him that he was a World War II soldier on the other side. That's the whole point, cried Stan. That's what this project is about. He started doing that old elementary school hands game in which your fingers act out the rhyme that runs. Here's the church, here's the steeple. Stan noticed his knuckles had gotten barked from connecting with Brad Strop's chin last night. Oh, well. Open the doors. You spread your thumbs open as if they were ancient oaken cathedral doors or something. And out come the people. The eight fingers, dovetailed, now turned upward. Stan finished the game because it was addictive and then said, You may not know because you probably don't have much to do with the police. Or maybe you do, since you are a social worker. Anyway, in this town, whenever there is a crime that isn't just USA vandalism, but a major crime, well, like the one discovered yesterday, that dead girl found in the ditch alongside 53, the police go questing the same old bunch of locals. May seem like a dumb thing to do, but their budget is about $1.50. What can anyone do with that? So they get around to all their usual suspects, long shots or not. Here's my point. They always question old Dieter Stoltz. Word is they are going to question him about this new murder, too. The girl out along Highway 53. Dieter has got to be 78 or 80. He just isn't someone who would rape and kill and dump off a young girl. If he was up for that, he'd have been doing it ever since the late 1940s or whenever he got to the States. Not now, not out of the clear blue sky. But people get some one opinion and they can't drop it. Well, no, now that I think about it, it's fun for them. Stan thought, I don't need to tell her that it's being married to Ginny that's shown me what people do when they're bored. They go after someone close by who's different from themselves. He thought of the trash around town, specifically Brad Strop, talking at the VFW, starting off his remarks with, Say what you will. Aloud, he said, Well, dumb or not, here's my idea. We do something about it. So here's as far as I've got. We plan our regular annual for our old soldiers around here, Veterans Night. This year, we use it to ward off all this finger-pointing at Dieter. We'll have a fancy lunch for after, stuff from both the Super Value and Denims, so there's no bad feeling. We honor Dieter Stoltz, who is as much an old soldier as anyone else around here. Stan stopped talking and glanced down at his hands. They lay quietly enough on his knees, but his face felt full of blood. He said, "My God Almighty, but that sounds so dumb." Imogene said, "How would you work it? Would it be kind of a surprise party for Dieter, or what?" He told her that his mother, she knew his mother, Bridget, the librarian, she did. His mother and he were running through a bunch of German and German-American websites, chat rooms, those chat rooms now, to drop into a few dozen of those, you'd think half the world were old Nazis still going strong. Or worse, 14-year-old American Nazi wannabes. Some websites were genuine links to German archives, especially those in Bonn, and so his mother and he had been chewing through a lot of them at night. "My mother is a computer-aholic, anyhow. My mother lives in Denim Apartments, if you know them, second floor, right above the bakery, actually. Those old ladies have supper parties, once a week, anyway. At the last one, she said that two of the others had heard from an official that the cops always kept an eye on foreigners. So I asked, what official would that be? The official was the deputy who works with the chief of police. She was talking about Daryl, that kind of riffraff deputy cop. You probably don't know him. But Imogene did. She said, I know him. I know Daryl. We deal with one another now and again. Stan's respect for her took a lift. He supposed anybody could be some kind of psychologist or social worker or whatever she exactly was. But you'd need the money to get a college education. That was okay. That was what he was here for, because this Imogene Tenebrae was a trained professional. But now that she had to deal with your very average cold-hearted trash, same as he did, he felt more trust in her. My mother has always told me you can Google your way to anywhere except heaven. She was going to. If I tell you what it is, you don't tell anybody, right? He looked over quickly. Nothing leaves this room, Stan, except what you tell people yourself. I knew that. I shouldn't have asked. Yes, but you should ask. You have to be 100% sure. I'm okay with the fact that you asked, Imogene said. Well, yesterday, like everyone else, I dropped into Denham's to hear whatever the latest was on that dead girl. And last night, at the VFW, every place crowded, and Brad Strop was shouting around about this time. If this town and countryside was going to be safe for women and children, we were going to get that Stoltz and make it stick. My mother thought she might do something in the library if she's sitting at the computer all the time. It looks as if she's doing ordinary office work. She wondered if she might find his family. What if she found a sister or a brother, and we'd bring them over from Germany? Stan began to feel stupid, and then angry at himself. All this talk, he also felt a return of the morning sickness. He hurried. He told her just the minimum. Some guy who works high up in a huge company in Roseville. His mother got onto him in a chat room, so Mama asked him right away how he knew Dieter. It's the strangest thing. This fellow is a German-American who joined our army in 1943. This man had spoken German in his family, so they put him in Army Intelligence. He was serving in the Ardennes Forest in the early spring of 1945. All the men he was with were killed. He himself was taken prisoner by a very young German sergeant. He remembered his name, but that was all. He wanted to find him, to thank him, to see what he was doing. Of course, Stan's mother, Bridget Garris, got all excited. Why wouldn't she? Imogene probably understood this even better than Stan did. What can your usual bunch of women in St. Fursey, Minnesota, talk about week after week? Those old ladies up there in Denim Apartments, they weren't like Stan's mother. They couldn't any more double-click on a chat room than they could shoot a bear. So, of course, Stan's mother got all excited. Here was American history connected right into her town. He told Imogene they meant to pull this off the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Every Wednesday was church night in St. Fursey, reserved for choir practice and all. Well, since all churches' chorus would be singing Friday, they could give up that particular Wednesday. Another thing Imogene put in, some kids will be home from college for the weekend. They should hear this. Grown males being serious. All so long ago, too. Now, Stan, did you want to say the third thing you had in mind? The reason I ask is you have time. You still have 15 minutes. And I haven't got another appointment either, so if you go over, that is okay. I will tell you, if you go over a lot, I will charge you for the next half hour. He said, I have to tell you I was a little scared to tell you about this business for old soldiers. I know you work part-time for a peace organization in Duluth. You might not approve. Imogene's face took on a hard look. She said mildly, it has to be very scary being a soldier. It has to be. You'd have to know that unless you were awfully lucky. You might never get to live out the whole grown-up adult life we think we have a right to. She seemed to give herself a little shake. Anyway, I'd be scared, she said. Wait a sec, Stan said. He put his head down between his shoulders and pretended to be fishing for his handkerchief. He didn't have one because it was Saturday, and he hated carrying a handkerchief. He had to have one at work because a proprietor of a business like his can't pull a Kleenex out of his pocket. But he hated the idea. Still, having a handkerchief on you was like being those poor saps who leapt to their feet the moment the organist had finished playing the hymn once through, because they had a little kid's taste for obeying rules. He actually was crying for a second. He decided to tell her it was just for a second, though. Wait a sec, he said. I am crying for a second. I'll be right there. She waited without emotion or a sound. She didn't say anything like, it's good to cry. Go ahead and cry. She just sat there and stayed out of his face. Soon he said, maybe my hour is up now. You have 10 more minutes if you want them, she said in a very low voice. Maybe I will come back someday and tell you about the third thing. Maybe I will. Maybe I will. Now that I know you don't think those two ideas are dumbass, he said. I don't know why I would use language like that with you. I am a car dealer, for God's sake. I know you can't use dirty language on the job. I know that. So why'd I do it? Imogene laughed suddenly. It's because I am a therapist. People feel free to use the worst language they know with a therapist. I think I know all the bad language now anyway. Then he was out. It was awful to be out. He went carefully down the staircase of her building. He said to himself, I am not in love with her, not even thinking about it. So what is this all about? That's easy, stupid. I need a friend. She is going to be my friend. Hell no, she isn't going to be a friend. I will not go back to see her again. I may be stupid, but I am not that stupid. Still, I will always know, in some sense, she is a friend. Halfway down the now very dark staircase, he stopped. Nope, that isn't it, he said half aloud. She won't be a friend. Here's what it is. Now that I have talked to her, I have learned something. I have learned there are intelligent people around. I now know that. The ones who are alive, like this Imogene, will be alive long after me. Millions of them are already dead, just the way millions of everybody are already dead. But millions of them are still alive. Intelligent people, not just tricky operators, not dumbasses. Intelligent people.
You've been listening to episode 4 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the program's drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.